The Violin Concerto by Alexander Glazunov. Mikhail Pletnyov conducted the Russian National Orchestra and the soloist was Gil Shaham. Next week's 20th Century Violin Concerto is Szymanowski's second, and Rob's chosen a recording by Frank-Peter Zimmermann. Well, that's all for this Sunday morning. I'm James Jolly. I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music today, and do join Rob next Sunday from 9 o'clock. Meanwhile, have an enjoyable and music-filled week. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Opera on 3 is back for a new season. Radio 3 travels to Glyndebourne to bring you a brilliant early opera by the 18-year-old Mozart, La Finta Giardiniera, with a story that follows seven characters searching for love and trying to discover what is real and what is pretending. Soprano Christiana Karg sings the title role of the fake gardener, with Glyndebourne's new music director Robin Ticciati conducting the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. So join me, Martin Handley, to kickstart the Opera on 3 season with Mozart's La Finta Giardiniera from Glyndebourne, tomorrow evening at 7:15, or listen in HD sound via the Radio 3 website.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the mathematician Sir Timothy Gowers.
Timothy Gowers is the son of a composer, the brother of a violinist, and a keen jazz pianist. But that's not actually how he makes a living. In fact, he's one of the country's most distinguished mathematicians, a fellow of the Royal Society. He was awarded the prestigious Fields Medal and knighted 2 years ago for services to mathematics. He's a professor at Trinity College, Cambridge, which has been a congenial habitat for mathematicians as far back as Isaac Newton. But despite all that, Timothy, I think it must be quite hard to spend your life doing something which so few people around you actually understand.
That's definitely one of the disadvantages of a career in mathematics. It does have many advantages, such as basically getting paid to do what you would probably want to do anyway. But the fact that I can't really talk in detail about my work to anybody except other mathematicians is a sadness in my life and the lives of many other mathematicians. I can't even really talk to my wife. She's a medieval historian, and she can tell me about her work. And then the best I can do in response is just to say, oh, I'm working on a problem that I'm quite excited by, and then she can watch me when I say, the idea that I thought was going to work yesterday doesn't work, and that sort of thing. But nothing about the actual problem itself and why it's interesting to me.
One thing I'd love to understand, and I'm afraid this is going to be a slightly embarrassing question, but you have had these accolades heaped on you, you know, only 50 and you've been knighted. Can you explain what it is you've achieved in mathematics that has brought you this recognition?
Well, in just very general terms, I've solved some long-standing open problems, and in one case, actually, it wasn't that I solved a problem, that I came up with a new proof of an existing theorem that was sufficiently different from the two original proofs, that was sufficiently different from them and had sufficiently different implications for other parts of mathematics that it was considered as an important thing in its own right.
Well, that's very helpful, modest.
So I like problems that are easy to state but difficult to solve.
As I said at the beginning, your father, Patrick Gowers, extremely good composer, probably best known for his music for Smiley's People and Jeremy Brett's Sherlock Holmes series. And in fact, we're going to hear one of his pieces later. And then your sister, Catherine's a very gifted violinist. So it must have been an intensely musical upbringing.
Yes, it certainly was. And my mother is a piano teacher, so there was always music going on in the household. And my father worked at home, so we could hear him playing the piano as he was composing. That would come down. That was one of the sounds of my childhood.
And you were a choir boy at King's College, Cambridge. And I think this piece by Robert Parsons was one of the first pieces you sang.
It is, but I didn't really come to appreciate it fully, I think, until much later when I heard a recording of it and thought, oh, wow, yes, the things that I noticed in it that I hadn't noticed when I sang it.
What is it?
Well, one of the things, actually, is just the way the trebles come in. The first few entries of the treble, each one is a note higher than the entry before, and it produces this amazing structure to the whole opening of the piece.
Thank you.
Ave Maria by Robert Parsons. And I'm afraid, Timothy Gowers, that was the choir I sang in.
Oh, is it really?
Westminster Cathedral Choir, conducted by James O'Donnell, rather than the one you sang in, which is, of course, King's College, Cambridge.
Well, it was actually this recording that was the one that really made me go from quite liking this piece to absolutely loving it. I got a disc of Renaissance anthems. The whole disc is actually wonderful, but this really stood out, I think.
You went on singing until you were 18. Were you ever tempted to follow your father's footsteps into music?
Yes, up to a point. So one thing that happened when I was 11 was that I was one of the winners of the Bach Choir Carol competition. So at that time, I felt if I'd won a competition, then maybe this was the thing for me. I think the problem I had with writing music was just the feeling, what shall I write? It wasn't so much, you know, if somebody said, write a piece in this style with these elements and so on, and as a little exercise, I might have been able to do it, but I just didn't have strong ideas of what I wanted to do in that direction. But it's a thought that I've never entirely given up, and I think that I would be disappointed if an angel appeared to me now and said, you're going to reach the end of your life never having composed a serious piece of music. So I haven't quite let go of the hope that I will one day do it.
Well, we're going to hear some music by your father, Patrick, played on this recording rather wonderfully by your son, Richard. I think this recording came about, or at least Richard learning it, as a kind of present to your father. And sadly, he's not able to compose or play anymore now, is he?
13 years ago, he had a really very serious stroke, which put an end to his composing. It was a devastating thing to happen. But he still very much appreciates music, and this was an extraordinary thing that Richard did. He learnt the piece without telling anybody. Well, he told his organ teacher, but he didn't tell anyone in the family. And my daughter, who's now 3 and a half, I have a daughter of 3 and a half, was christened 3 years ago. So he was 16 at the time. And it would normally have happened in Trinity, but the Trinity Chapel was out of commission at the time. And so we were allowed to have the service in a side chapel in King's Chapel. And Richard was allowed to play the organ. And at the end of the service, we were all expecting him to play, because that's what he'd said he was going to do, a fugue that comes after the, what my father wrote much later, to go with the Toccata. And the fugue is a much easier piece. And so I was sitting there waiting for the fugue to start. And the Toccata started. And it was a sort of double surprise. First of all, that we didn't know that's what he was going to play. And secondly, that he could play it at all, because it's a fiendishly difficult piece. And the idea that he'd managed to learn it was quite extraordinary.
Well, this is a performance that Richard recorded in Leipzig, I think.
That's right, yes, which is where he's been spending this year.
Thank you. The Organ Toccata by Patrick Gowers, a piece composed by the father of my guest today, Timothy Gowers, and played by his son, Richard, who's 19. You were obviously only a child when you first heard that piece played by Simon Preston, for whom it was written. And I wonder what you thought of it then.
Well, those opening chords were a little bit much for me at that age.
Do you particularly value pieces subsequently that you didn't, in fact, understand at first hearing?
Yes, I would say that most of the pieces that I really like are ones that at first I've been a little puzzled by, or there's something in them that I, or even actually disliked, and have, something that I've had to conquer it in order to get pleasure out of them.
Yeah, maybe there isn't a problem to divine if it's too straightforward, so although it may make an impression, it's not, doesn't sit in the memory as something to get to the bottom of.
Something like that, yes. I think it's partly also because of this feeling that I haven't quite given up the idea of being a composer, that I like having pieces where I want to understand, possibly with a view to using some of the tricks that the composer has used and that sort of.
Well, I think this next piece is perhaps the most extreme example of that experience, isn't it?
It is, yes. This is a piece I really positively disliked when I first heard it. I very much liked Tippett's music, or some of it. The first pieces I got to know were the double orchestra concerto and the Fantasia on the theme of Corelli. And then some of his pieces I thought, well, if he could write those nice pieces like the double orchestra concerto, why does he write this? I gradually got to like things like his symphonies, which were a bit less easy to get to like in the first place. And at some point I decided I'd give his piano sonatas a try. And then this one was so dissonant, I thought at first, that I was almost annoyed with Tippett. But I gave it a chance, and there were certain passages in it that were easier to like than others. There's a sort of runny bit that comes in various guises through the movement.
Well, there are various things which I can imagine might appeal to you. Tippett loved jazz, and I think he taught maths at one point. And also the structure of this is interesting.
Yes, there's a sort of mirror symmetry. The left hand and the right hand are playing as reflections of each other throughout the whole movement.
Thank you. It's full of those sprung and dotted rhythms that Tippett really loved. Ba-dum, ba-dum, which comes very much from his love of early music.
And something I've only took a long time to appreciate is some of the harmony that I found initially, just straightforwardly discordant. I came not just to like it, but actually to sort of see that actually it was Tippett-ish.
Stephen Osborne playing the first movement of Tippett's third piano sonata. There are details of all these recordings on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. You've mentioned listening to music over and over again. Is there ever a point at which music can become too familiar?
I think there definitely is. And in fact, all the pieces that we're listening to are ones that I very rarely listen to because I just feel that listening to them slightly risks spoiling them. And so I sort of have them in my brain in some way. And with pieces I really like, I'd like to sort of hear them, either hear them live or catch them accidentally on the car radio. That's maybe the most common way in which I will end up listening to a piece of music that's one of my absolute favourites.
This piece we're going to hear next is something that I think you fell in love with fairly immediately.
Although I've said that that isn't necessarily the best thing as far as my long-term interest in a piece is concerned, this is an exception. I heard this piece first, actually, while in the middle of a performance of it in which I was participating. I was a chorister. We did the St. Matthew Passion on two consecutive evenings, but we only rehearsed the few parts that we were involved in, so I didn't hear the solo arias until the performance itself. And so I was sitting there, and we'd sung probably for an hour and a half or something, and then Barma Dick started, and the violin solo started. That's what I really fell in love with at the time. And I was just completely entranced immediately.
It's almost unbearably beautiful, isn't it?
It's an incredible piece of music, yes.
And I think that performance is absolutely wonderful. Robin Blaise is a glorious countertenor.
It is. This was a good example of a piece where it was quite difficult to find a performance that was had the right sort of clarity, particularly in the violin solo. No notes got swallowed. And the singing just is breathtaking as well.
You went through quite a few, didn't you?
Yes.
To choose the right one.
Yes, I mean, I liked aspects of a lot of recordings, but this one had everything, I thought.
Robin Blaise singing the aria Erbarme dich, Have Mercy, from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Masaki Suzuki conducting the Bach Collegium of Japan. Jazz next, and I know that, Timothy Gowers, you're a very keen jazz pianist.
Yes. My father introduced me to jazz when I was a teenager. He made a tape that played a blues bass, had bass and drums. He made it on a synthesizer, and it played through a 12-bar blues twice in C, and it went up to C-sharp, and then went twice in C-sharp, and twice in D, twice in E-flat, and so on. And every time it had gone through the entire octave twice, it had doubled in speed, so it was a practice tape for beginning jazz players.
You worked in Princeton for a couple of years and played in a big band there.
Yes, that's right. Yes, one of the university big bands.
So tell us about the piece you've chosen, which obviously, given your passion for it, it must be pretty good.
I think it's absolutely marvellous. It's by a very obscure, at least in this country, obscure pianist called Bill Mays, who I would never have heard of had it not been for accidentally catching this track on the car radio while I was in Princeton. He lives and works in Philadelphia. There are various remarkable things about it, I think. One is that the tune that it's based on, Indian Summer, is a Glenn Miller composition, but this couldn't be less like Glenn Miller. If it was Glenn Miller-ish, then I wouldn't have chosen it. So it's extremely reworked from the Glenn Miller original. But another thing that's remarkable about it is that it's in five time, but played so sort of delicately and subtly that I didn't actually notice it was in five time until I'd listened to it more than once. So it's very different from something like Take Five with the Dave Brubeck Quartet, which is a rather sort of, compared with this, a rather clunky five time, whereas this is just very sort of... I think one can perceive that something is not quite 4/4-ish about it, because notes sort of come where you don't quite expect them to. But it takes a while to realise that just... that's what's behind it, just in five. It's beautifully done, I think.
Thank you.
Bill May's trio with music from Indian Summer, a tune by Glenn Miller and adapted there by a trio, so at least four people have collaborated to make that music. And I'm saying that because collaboration is something you're very interested in, Timothy Gowers, in mathematics. In fact, you started a blog to get mathematicians from all over the world to try to solve problems collectively, and I wonder how much success you had with it.
Yes, well, I had a blog for, I'd had it at that stage for a year or two, and it had built up a reasonable following. And I had the thought that maybe one could do better trying to solve maths problems if everybody pooled their resources. So the way it works normally is that people are very private about their work until they've got a polished, finished product. But that doesn't seem like necessarily the most efficient way of proceeding because different people have different talents, or if people get wedded to their own ideas that may be wrong, you can waste a lot of time trying to prove something that's not true because you hope it's true, and then you start to believe that it's true and lose your critical faculty to some extent. But it's much easier to spot a flaw in somebody else's thought of that kind. So there are all sorts of reasons to think that if people could set aside their personal ambitions, so to speak,
and work tall together, order.
Yeah, well, it was, but the thought that then occurred to me was that if you did everything out in the open in public in the form of blog comments, then everything would be time-stamped, and people would, when they were making a comment, instead of, so to speak, giving away the idea and risking being scooped and so on, they would be laying claim to that little idea in the edifice. And I think that motivation actually worked. Anyway, I suggested a problem. I had an initial thought about how one might tackle it. And in fact, that wasn't the way it eventually got solved, but in a very, very short space of time by mathematical standards. So this was about 5 weeks. This quite hard problem got solved. And I think if I'd tried to do it on my own, then either I wouldn't have solved it, that would have been the most likely, or it would have taken me, you know, 2 years or something like that.
People probably enjoyed sort of pitting themselves against you, or at least just working with your ideas.
It wasn't just people working with my ideas, it was very much the other way around as well. Yes, it did give quite a lot of pleasure. And another thing that was interesting about it was that there are very few places where if you want to see the research process in action, you can, and here you could.
Maybe it's a bit like when a composer who is essentially leading a rather solitary existence, and I imagine mathematicians can, at least people assume they do.
No, I think it's a reasonable description.
That when you then turn to do something collaborative, like working with a librettist or a director or something, that's very, very liberating because actually you are having a sort of social intercourse with other people.
Yes, that was definitely part of the fun of it. I got slightly, as my wife would tell you, slightly obsessed with this thing while it was going on, and I would come down to breakfast to see whether people over in the States had been making interesting contributions while I'd been asleep and that sort of thing.
So that's an example of mathematical collaboration. But your next piece evokes really intense loneliness, and it's Ravel's Le Gibet, A View of the Desert, the lone corpse of a hanged man swinging on a gibbet, a bell tolling from inside the walls of a far-off city. Is it the picture here that appeals to you, or is it simply the sound of the music?
It's principally the sound, and particularly in parts, there's a sort of bell-like part where you get chords starting out far apart and getting gradually closer and closer, and the harmony there I find absolutely wonderful. I also like the B-flat going through the whole piece, and you can't quite believe how much harmonic variation he manages to get. But I think knowing what it's called can't fail to influence one's perception of the piece.
Thank you. We heard music from Ravel's Le Gibet, the central movement of Gaspard de la Nuit, with the pianist Pierre-Laurent Aymar. So you've opened up maths to the idea of collaboration, Timothy Gowers, and you're also keen to show how we can apply mathematical solutions to some of life's most difficult problems. In fact, you did this very dramatically a couple of years ago when you were trying to decide whether or not to have an operation on your heart.
Yes, that's. I had to decide whether to go ahead and have an operation called a catheter ablation to correct an arrhythmia in my heart called atrial fibrillation. And this was an operation that was not without its risks, but atrial fibrillation is also not without its risks. Mm. And so, but then it was difficult to balance those risks because the operation, you would be having your risks straight away, whereas with atrial fibrillation, the risk that you face is at some unknown time in the future. But it was very real to me because it was that actually caused my father's stroke that we mentioned earlier. So I was quite keen to avoid the same thing happening to me. And so I didn't quite know how to set about working out what the rational thing to do was faced with this choice. My consultant seemed to be fairly clear that the right thing to do was to have the operation, but I didn't want to take his word for it because, you know, he would say that, wouldn't he? Was my feeling. Actually, eventually, the argument that swayed me was quite simple. I thought, why didn't I look up what mortality risk was for somebody my age over the course of a year? And I discovered that by having the operation, I was concentrating about 2 months' risk into one operation. And since I wasn't worried about the next 2 months, I shouldn't be worried about having the operation. At least that was the calculation I eventually did. So I went ahead and had it. And actually, then a year later, I had to have it again. It's something that doesn't always work the first time. And but I think it's the last time was a few months ago, and it seems as though it may have worked now.
You look very healthy. So we're very glad that your maths have probably proved you right and that you're still here and playing the jazz piano. So for a final choice, let's call it a celebratory piece, we're going to hear that great pianist Oscar Peterson. What made you choose this?
Just because this is a piece that's been a favourite of mine ever since I've been listening to jazz. It was one of the pieces my father introduced me to. The tune itself, Con Alma, a Dizzy Gillespie composition, has an interesting chord sequence. It's not one of the sort of... Some jazz standards have rather standard chord sequences, and this is a bit less so. Another thing is that it's a bit more arranged. It's a bit less like some things where you just play through the tune and then everybody improvises on the chord sequence and you come back and play the tune again. It's a bit... It's more arranged at the beginning. But when Oscar Peterson does eventually let fly and he leaves the arranged part behind and just purely improvises, he has a kind of lightness of touch and gentle playing around with rhythm that I think is remarkable. And at the bottom there's a 12-8 time and he soars above it, with sometimes going against it and sometimes with it, and it works fantastically well.
Well, as we listen to it, can I just... thank you, Timothy Gowers, for a really fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Music from Dizzy Gillespie's Con Alma in a version by the Oscar Peterson Jazz Trio. Oscar Peterson on piano with Ray Brown on bass and Egg Thigpen on drums. Michael Barclay's guest was the mathematician Sir Timothy Gowers. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And you can find details of how to download that programme and others in the series on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael's guest is the writer Charles Spencer.
In a three-part series on BBC Radio 3, I'll be setting out to measure the impact of the new global passion for Western classical music. I'm Petroc Trelawney, and in the first programme, I'll be looking at what have been described as cultural monuments, grand new concert halls springing up across China, including Zaha Hadid's iconic Guangzhou Opera House.
It's a sign of where your city is. You know, all great cities, all world cities must have an opera house, must have a concert hall, must have a symphony orchestra. So it's that kind of thinking.
The Sunday feature, Global Classical Music, A New World Symphony. Tonight at 7:15 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's just after 1 o'clock, time now for the news with John Shea.
The Labour leader Ed Miliband has insisted that Scotland will get new powers following the no vote in the independence referendum. The First Minister, Alex Salmond, accused the main parties at Westminster of reneging on promises on tax and welfare because he claimed change in Scotland was being linked to change in England. But Mr Miliband said more devolution would be delivered with no ifs, no buts. He also said he would be open to greater scrutiny of MPs voting on laws that affect England. David Cameron wants only English MPs to decide such matters. The United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, says around 70,000 Syrians have crossed into Turkey in the last 24 hours and that it expects many more in the coming days. Most are Kurds seeking refuge from Islamic State, which is reported to have taken over 64 villages in northern Syria. One Kurdish leader accused the jihadists of committing genocide and has called for the international community to intervene. Pope Francis has strongly criticised extremists who, as he put it, pervert religion to justify violence and oppression. The Pope was speaking in Albania. It's the first European country outside Italy which he's visited since he took office last year. Pope Francis praised Albania for its religious harmony. Afghanistan's two rival presidential candidates have signed an agreement to share power in a government of national unity. Under the deal, which comes almost 6 months since Afghan voters first went to the polls, the winner, Ashraf Ghani, becomes president. The losing candidate, Abdullah Abdullah, will nominate a chief executive, which is equivalent to a prime minister. Labour delegates are gathering in Manchester for the party's annual conference, where a pledge has been made to raise the minimum wage from £6.50 to £8 an hour. Ed Miliband said if he became Prime Minister, this would happen by 2020. The Conservatives say the coalition has delivered the first above-inflation pay rise for the minimum wage since the recession. And the weather. It'll be a fine and fresh afternoon with sunny intervals, although there's a chance of a light shower in eastern England. And that's the news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:03.
And that was John Shea. Looking ahead to 2 o'clock in the early music show, we'll be hearing the last of Sophie Yates's three programmes marking the 250th anniversary of the death of Rameau. She'll be playing a recital on the restored Rooker's Hemsch harpsichord at Hatchlands, music by Fouqueray and Rameau. That's at 2 o'clock. But now it's time for the Radio 3 lunchtime concert and another chance to hear last Monday's live broadcast from Wigmore Hall in London. It was introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Wigmore Hall. I should say welcome back after the summer. This is the first Radio 3 lunchtime concert of the season. And today we're expecting the pianist Marc-André Hamelin, French-Canadian, known for his astonishing virtuosity, to come out in just a couple of moments onto the platform. He's one of a handful of pianists alive today who can really tackle the most fiendishly difficult of pianistic repertoire from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And today he's going to play some of Godofsky's Etudes after Chopin's, described as probably the most difficult thing ever written for the piano. But before that, he's starting today's lunchtime recital with the second set of piano impromptus which Schubert wrote the year before he died. Each one, between 5 and 10 minutes long, is completely different. One is a set of theme and variations, another like a condensed sonata, one brooding, another lively, but they all share the effortless lyricism of Schubert's late works. So to perform the four impromptus Deutsch 935 by Schubert, here is the pianist Marc-André Hamelin.